my buddies, my peer group would have said, "Hey, what the hell's wrong with you, Bobby? You're talking really weird. You're getting really weird. What are you taking? You know, what are you doing? Get in the car. We're going to a meeting." You know, somebody would have seen me getting weird. And I never would have gone out that far if I'd been doing what I'd always told other people to do, which is go to a lot of meetings. So that's as good a reason as I can tell you why you need to go to meetings. And so we're glad you're here. And we hope you're glad you're here. And we know that, you know, if you can find it within yourself to keep faith with Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, your life is going to be one that you'll be happy to participate in. I reported for duty in Alcoholics Anonymous on April the 14th of 1976 in a little place called Town North Group in Dallas, Texas. And the facts of my life were not good at that time. The facts were I was drinking 6 half-gallons of vodka a week. I know precisely the number because every Friday afternoon, the mailman delivered a check to me for $63. And it came from the Texas State Unemployment Commission because I was unemployed and I was unemployable. And so the check came, and when the check came, I cashed it. I didn't have a bank account. Because when you owe as many people as much money as I did, and when you had been as tacky to all of them as I had been, they just hover around your bank account waiting for you to put $5 in it, and the minute it hits, they got it. So you can't have a bank account when you live like that. So I would cash the check and go down to Thrifty Drug down on Walnut Hill. And Thrifty Drug was one of those drug stores that had a liquor department. They sold booze. And I bought a case of whatever vodka was on sale in the wire rack. Whatever was on sale that week, I bought it. And it was always about $44. And it had been a long time since I was a brand name shopper. I don't even remember what I was drinking. It was whatever was on sale, and it varied from week to week, but I'll guarantee it wasn't Smirnoff. And I would buy my case, and that's what I drank from one Friday to the next. That's what it took to keep me going. And the reason I bought it by the case, I mean, is I've always been kind of anal about everything, but the reason I bought it by the case is because I didn't trust myself. I was not a trustworthy person, and I was afraid that if I didn't lay in my week's supply while I had that money, then in a moment of weakness along the way, I would waste some of my drinking money on food or clothing or rent or something and wind up for the next Friday without any booze, and there's no way I could take that chance. I mean, I could not take that chance. Because when I woke up every morning at that stage of my life, when my eyes flew open in the morning, when my blood alcohol level dropped to a point where sleep was no longer possible, and my eyes flew open, I always knew two things. I always knew that if I didn't stop drinking, pretty soon I was going to die. And I always knew, if I don't have a drink in the next 5 seconds, I'm going to die. And that's the dilemma of the alcoholic that the book talks about, and that's what I was caught in. When I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on April the 14th, I came drinking, because that's the only way you got me. I had one of those big, tall Tupperware glasses, and I liked those a lot. I had a bunch of them. Because you could get those styrofoam coasters and the glass with it down in the coaster, and you could carry it around in your lap, and you didn't get your crotch wet from the sweating glass. So, you know, you didn't look like you'd wet yourself when you got out of the car. And so I had the styrofoam glass, a big tall one, in the styrofoam holder, and I would get so bad. I would carefully drink half of it on the way to the meeting, saving the other half to get me home. So that's how I came to my first few meetings. And when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had not had a bath in a long time. I don't know how long, but a long time. We're talking months here, not days. And, you know, if you hang with it, things like bathing just lose their importance. You know, bathing, brushing your teeth, combing your hair, changing clothes. You know, they just lose their importance. It doesn't matter anymore. You know, the thing is that my circumstances would not be improved one bit by a bath. You know, my material well-being would not be enhanced in any way if I took a bath. I mean, it's not going to make any difference. It doesn't matter anymore. And so I didn't. I tell you how long it had been if I knew, but those are, you know, if you knew one day you're going to be making speeches and all, you might keep some records so you can be a little more accurate. But I had no idea how long it had been, didn't care. But I walked into my first meeting on my second wife, and that marriage was hanging by a thread, and the name of the thread was vodka. We met while drunk. We lived together for a while drunk, because we drank just alike. If we were awake, we were drinking. And somewhere along the way, we got married drunk. And, you know, I honestly cannot tell you what year even we got married. I don't know. But somewhere in the early 70s, we got married. So not only do I not remember the month or the day, I don't even know the year we got married. I vaguely recall a Baptist minister whose services were hired for the occasion. And I remember that guy taking his $50 and getting the hell out of there as fast as he could. And boy, that poor guy, that's probably the toughest $50 he ever earned. So this marriage was hanging by a thread. This lady and I had no business being together, being married or anything. You know, we had nothing in common. We were just two old drunks. And, you know, that black, bottomless pit of loneliness that drunks know about is the hole we were both trying to get out of when we grabbed onto each other. You know, and the reason we stayed together was because the alternative was even worse. It was going back into the black, bottomless hole alone and living who knows where and doing who knows what. I walked into this meeting in Town North, and a couple of things happened to me that changed my life forever. One of the things was that a little lady named Helen Elliott was sober about 90 days, and she was absolutely on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. And she'd got a look at me, and she came over and gave me a big hug. And boy, she didn't flinch at all when she got a whiff of me. She just kept hugging, and she said, "We're glad you're here, and we hope you come back." You know, you can tell when somebody puts their arms around you and hugs you and says, "We're glad you're here," whether they mean it or not, especially, you know, when you're in the shape I was in. And I could tell that she meant it. And it had been a long, long time since anybody was glad I was there. They were glad when I wasn't there. That's when people were happy. That's what I was accustomed to. And it just really touched my heart. I mean, I was locked in from that point on. A guy named Buddy Newton stood at a podium that night, and he talked about being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I completely identified with Buddy. I don't know why. We had a lot of different things in our background. But Buddy talked about things that I understood. Buddy was from West Texas, and he talked about, and Buddy, in addition to alcohol, had a real bad turpentine problem. And can't get that stuff anymore, but used to be able to get it in cough syrup. And turpentine will set you free, I'm told. So Buddy talked about how, you know, wearing out of town. And I understood what he meant. You go to a small town that has only one drugstore, and they have only so many bottles of turpentine on the shelf, and after you drank all that, you got to move on to the next town. Nothing left, you know, no more left. You got to go somewhere else. So I was astounded. I was astounded at what Buddy said. I mean, I was literally blown off my chair. First of all, I would have bet anything I could put together at that point in my life that I was the only person that had ever thought those thoughts and felt that way and been in that kind of predicament until I heard Buddy talk. And secondly, I was astounded that he would stand at a podium in front of a room full of people and tell all that stuff about himself. You know, I'm sitting back there saying, oh, man, don't tell him that. Don't tell him that stuff. And, you know, so here I am, having been sober all this time, and for a long time now, I will stand up at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, and as far as good taste allows, will tell you anything you want to know about me. Anything. I do not care what you know about me at all. Anything. I don't even care if you know what I think. Because this program has set me free. Just like it had set him free. It just doesn't matter. Do I always think wonderful thoughts? Absolutely not. Neither do you. Neither do any of us. I mean, humans don't always think wonderful thoughts, but the point is, you know, I don't care if you know about me. I am free today. See, and it's not only this room full of people. I mean, often when you talk, somebody's recording what you're saying. And anybody's got $4 or whatever the cost is, you can go back there and buy that tape and send it to anybody in the world we want to send it to. And I don't care. You know? And that doesn't make me unique or special. It just makes me typical. That's just the way we are in Alcoholics Anonymous. This program sets us free to be who we are. And but that night, Buddy was doing that, and my life changed immeasurably. Now, I got to this meeting because a lady named Jeanette Beaver sent me there. Jeanette was a therapist at the Dallas County Mental Health Clinic. I was sitting there drinking one night, watching the public service announcements at 2 a.m., and they had one for the Dallas County Mental Health Clinic. And they said, you know, if you're depressed, you know, give us a call, maybe we can help you. And I knew there wouldn't be any charge because I didn't have a job. It's free. It's a county deal. And God knows I was depressed. I mean, drinking almost a half gallon of vodka a day, well, you know, after a while, when you're not eating any food to speak of, you get kind of depressed. And so I went down, and February, I believe, is when I started with Jeanette. Anyway, for a few weeks, for several weeks, 3 months, something like that, I'm going down every Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock to have my one-hour session with Jeanette. Now, I often think about this lady. You know, here's a lady who has gone through school. She's graduated from high school. She's enrolled in college. She's worked hard for a degree. Then she gets another degree, you know, an advanced degree, a master's degree. She's a psychologist. She's worked really hard for her credentials. And what has she got to look forward to for all this hard work? Me, every Monday at 1 o'clock. Here I come. Whoa. So, bless her heart. So I would show up every Monday at 1 o'clock, and I would tell Jeanette what was wrong in my life. And would you believe, you know, I mean, I would tell her about that craphead boss I used to have that fired me, you know, and this bitch I was married to. And all these people, I mean, look what these people have done to me. I would tell her all the things that are wrong with my life. And would you believe that none of it was my fault? None of it. I was just an innocent victim. And look what all these people have done to me. It's just absolutely remarkable. Poor me. And, you know, one of the very best things I can tell you about me today is that I am no longer a victim. You know, I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous that I am no longer a victim. You know, I have really come to understand that my problems are of my own making. And the good news is that I understand that, and I know that to be true. See, if my problems are of your making, I'm screwed. Because before my life can get any better, I got to get you to change. But if I can stand up and be responsible and accountable for myself and understand that my problems are of my own making, and if I want my life to get better, it's up to me. And what you do is what you do. And all I have to change is me. And about the only thing I really have to change is my attitude. You might think, so anyway, I would go down there every Monday afternoon and tell Jeanette what's wrong with me and how these other people did it to me. And finally one day I said, well, when are we going to talk about my drinking? And those therapists, man, she says, oh, do you have a drinking problem? So, I mean, you know, if any one of your five senses worked, you know, if you could see, if you could smell, you know, if you got one out of five of them clicking, you know I'm an alcoholic. But she said, you know, Dave, you really need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, why do you want me to go there? She said, because they do better than anybody. They're the only ones I know of that really know what to do for you. She said, in fact, if you'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't need to come back here anymore. She said, in fact, if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't even have to stay till the end of the cellar. So, bless her heart, she saved my life. And that's how I got here. That was a Monday night. I had to think about it for a couple of days, but I came in on a Wednesday night and had no idea where I was going or what was about to happen to me. And I often think that, you know, if I'd had any idea where I was going, if I'd really known where I was going, see, I knew where I was going. I knew. We all know things, right? I mean, alcoholics know truth like few other people. And I knew what was going to be here. You know, I'm just a bunch of old scruffy dudes. You know, crawl out from under a bridge, no shaves, no haircuts, you know, smell bad, look bad. You know, army overcoat, you know, rope belt, no socks. I knew what I was going to find here. You know, and I just kept thinking, God, it's come to this. So, you know, I walked into my first meeting, and the only person that fit my vision of an alcoholic was me. You know, and it took me a long time before I realized that. I was the only scruffy old dude there. Everybody else looked pretty good. In fact, the first guy that stuck out his hand to me, and this memory is one of the reasons I say I don't know if I would come if I'd known this, is because he was a doctor. He was there in a three-piece suit. He'd driven there in his Cadillac. He had his really pretty wife, Margaret, was with him. He was head of radiology at Parkland Hospital. And he's the first guy that stuck out his hand to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'd have known that, boy, I don't know if I'd have come or not. I don't think so. See, I was entirely too ashamed of what I had become, of what I was. I was just a smelly bum, and I was way too ashamed of that to be greeted by a doctor at the door of anything, even Alcoholics Anonymous, because I could not imagine him. I mean, see, it just didn't make any sense to me why he would be there. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it because I couldn't think very well anyway. But, you know, why would he be there? It never occurred to me that he might be an alcoholic, too. But I was. And, you know, I got here, I just could not endure one more episode of rejection. I had just been rejected right up to my maximum limit, and I just was not able to take any more rejection. And I knew that people like that would reject me like that in a heartbeat. And our book has a paragraph in the back. It was written by Herbert Spencer. It talks about contempt prior to investigation. And I had a lot of that. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't know where I was. I just know I wanted to come back. And the first miracle that happened in my life happened 4 days later. I kept coming in, and I kept coming to meetings drunk. When I was drunk, I didn't stagger, and I didn't slur my words or anything, but I was just drunk. And you kept telling me, you know, Dave, you need to ask God to help you quit drinking. Individually or collectively, that is something that is beyond our power. We cannot make you stop drinking. You know, and I don't know if you've ever noticed this or not, but the big book doesn't say a single thing about how to quit drinking. The big book just assumes that you either have or that you presently will, but it doesn't give you any clues on how. And these people told me that if I would go home and ask God to help me, that He would. To its everlasting credit, every single person I met kept faith with Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't try to give me any cute hints or workarounds or shortcuts or anything else. They told me the truth as they saw it, unerringly. And see, I was convinced, and I'm sure most of you were too, that if there really was a God, I wasn't sure there even was one, didn't care much one way or the other, but I was convinced that if there was a God, that I would be one of the last people on this earth that he would help. I mean, after all, look at me and look what I've done. And you know what I've come to believe now? Not only is there a God, but people like me are one of the first that he will help. Who could possibly need God more than a drinking alcoholic? Who could possibly need him more than us? So, I didn't believe that then, and I didn't really want to do what you were telling me I needed to do. But I worked out a plan with my keen alcoholic mind. Have you ever noticed that the only people who talk about having a keen alcoholic mind are alcoholics? Nobody else talks about it. Our keen alcoholic, keen mind, I'll tell you. But I worked out a plan. See, I'm getting nervous. I've been coming here 4 days, and you guys really are indicating that you like me, and I'm really liking you a lot. I mean, you're showing me kindness and all that, and I want to stay here, and I know you mean well, and I know you want me to quit drinking, and you like that, and I would if I could, you know, but you just don't seem to understand. I can't. But I worked out a plan, and my plan was I'm going to go home tonight after this meeting, and I'm going to ask God to help me quit drinking, and if it doesn't work, it's not my fault. You can't, you know... You can't kick me out because I did what you told me. And see, and everybody that's been sober for a while knows what I'm about to say. As I went home that night with my little Tupperware glass and my little styrofoam coaster, and I stood there with that drink in my hand in the dark living room of this little shack I was living in, this little dumpy apartment, and I said, God, if I'm going to quit drinking, you're going to have to help me because I can't do it by myself. And as near as I could tell, absolutely nothing happened. I finished that drink, and I had another one, and another one, and another one, and I did what I did every night. Eventually, I just fell over. But I got up the next morning, and I thought, you know, and it was Sunday morning, and I thought, I'm going to try to wait till after I go to that Sunday morning meeting before I start drinking today. And, boy, I'll tell you, 5 lifetimes went by between the time I woke up and the start of that meeting. But I managed to get there before I had a drink. And a fellow named John found out I hadn't had a drink that day, and he arranged for my ride home to vaporize. And he said he'd give me a ride home. Only problem is, he took me to his home, not my home. And he let me shake it out all day long in his apartment. I tried every way I could to get away from that guy so I'd go home and get that vodka. I mean, I used every trick I had. Unfortunately, I was dealing with a clever alcoholic who knew all the tricks. I told him, you know, I didn't want to be sick all over his carpet or anything. He said, no, don't worry about it. Drunks puke on that all the time. And the long and the short of it is, I did what you told me to do. In spite of the fact that I did not believe it would work, I was certain it wouldn't work. I was trying to run a scam on you so you wouldn't kick me out. But I did what you told me to do, and I haven't had a drink since. Have not even come close to having a drink. Have no desire to drink. In fact, the thought of having to be drunk again just leaves me, ugh, oh, I just can't bear the thought of having to be drunk again, ever. So, the thing has been completely removed. And I think that that my story, you know, I used to think that I had such a great, you know, that was such a great miracle in my life and all that, and that it was very unusual and all. It's not unusual. You know, is it a miracle? I think it's a miracle, knowing what kind of person I was and knowing what happened to me. Do I think it's a miracle? Do I think God intervened in my life? Yes, I do, frankly. Because I had no doubt about how powerless I was over alcohol. I was totally and completely powerless over alcohol. There were no decisions to make when my eyes flew open in the morning. There wasn't anything to think about or decide upon. It's get in the kitchen and get the vodka down quick or we're going to die. And you pray that that first drink stays down. And when it doesn't, you pray that the second one does. And when it doesn't, you pray that the third one does. Now, I had no doubts about that. So, yes, I believe that I'm a miracle. But I believe you are, too. And no, I don't think I'm unique anymore. I found out I'm not unique at all. I'm just typical. I'm just typical of the miracles that are found in Alcoholics Anonymous. No big deal. We live surrounded by miracles like that 7 days a week, all the time. I've had a lot of things happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing that happened was I made the unfortunate mistake of getting in a very active group, and they thought working the steps was a really great idea. I didn't think it was such a hot idea. But I have one great asset that I've had in my life for a long time, and it became very helpful at this time of my life. I have always been a suck-up people pleaser, and so you'd like me, you know, like my joke, you know, so you'd like me, and I'll do whatever you want if you'll promise to like me. You know, I'm just as addicted to approval as I ever was to alcohol, and so when people told me I needed to do things, I would do it so they'd like me. So, you know, I worked some steps in this program so my sponsor would like me. And you know what? Those steps don't know who's working them or why. And they just seem to work, you know, no matter what your motivation may be. And I found that was true in my case. You know, and I had all the usual problems that newcomers have. You know, I could look back over my life and I could justify every single thing I had ever done. Every rotten, two-bit, crummy thing I'd ever done, I could easily justify it by just looking back at my life and look at what happened to me. You know, I mentioned somewhere today about the John Bradshaw thing and going back to, you know, find your inner child and all. You know, I had a terrible childhood. You know, I could drink for years over my childhood. I was raised in shacks, you know, in just abject poverty. You know, we were just, you know, just poor white trash. And if you're raised poor white trash and you've been molested out on the streets and things like this, you know, you learn to have a lot of secrets. You don't let nobody know what's going on with you. Because it's pretty obvious. If you know what kind of person I am, you're going to throw me away. You know, that doesn't take an Einstein to figure that out. You know, when you're a little kid, you don't let people know things. When I was abused, when I was sexually molested on the street, I was just a little boy. About in fourth grade, maybe fifth grade, I don't even remember, somewhere along in there. And not a soul but me knew about that until I had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for some years. I don't remember how long, but 4 or 5 years. Not another soul on this planet knew about that. I just packed that around with me. You know what that did to me? I don't have the faintest idea, but I'm sure it did something. It damn sure wasn't beneficial. Whatever effect it had on me, it wasn't beneficial. You know, but I learned to have a lot of secrets. And boy, there's one thing an alcoholic can't afford, it's secrets. But I had a lot of them. And any time I needed to justify my drinking, I can look back anywhere in my past and find some reason. You know, if this had happened to you, you'd drink too. It's easy. We can all do that. And we all have, over and over and over. And I was raised by parents who, you know, I could look at them. God, they're easy to blame. You know, my stepfather didn't like to work, so he didn't. And, you know, and there were lots of times when I would have some piddly little job and my mother would borrow money from me just to buy food to feed our family because I was the only one that had any because I had a paper route or I was, you know, selling something door to door or whatever. And I can't let you know about that. You must be kidding. You'll throw me away. When I got to be 16 years old, that's when the first miracle of my life happened. Me and some buddies got a case of beer, stole some beer, went to the beach. I got to drink as much as I wanted to for the first time, and I got drunk. Boy, did I get drunk. Whoa, what a night that was. You know, you get about 15 minutes there between the time you start really feeling it and you start puking. And, you know, and when that happened to me, I was okay for the first time in my life. I felt okay for the first time ever in my whole life. For that 15 minutes, I forgot all about being white trash. I forgot all about all that other stuff. I was okay. And if you think I'm letting that go with one only trip, no chance. There's no way I'm going to do that. And so I just slowly, from that point, became a full-blown, daily drinking alcoholic. And I got married when I was 23. I met this lady when I was in my early 20s, and she was a nurse. One night we were out partying, and I had to drive home, and we'd had a few too many. And she said, here, take this, and you won't get sleepy driving home. So she just gave me a little orange triangular pill. I didn't ask her what it was. I just took it. But the next morning, I was on the phone calling her saying, what was that, and how much more have you got? And she said, that was dextroamphetamine sulfate. And this wife of mine, I married her. I'm no dummy. And she, I found out, could order anything she wanted to from any drug company in the country because she worked for an internal medicine specialist who ordered drugs directly from the drug companies all the time. And all she had to do was tack whatever I wanted onto the tail end of one of his orders, and it was delivered to us. And not only that, but we got it at a wholesale price. So I'm buying bottles of dextroamphetamine sulfate, bottles of 1,000 for $5.75 a bottle. And I'm buying them 2 or 3 bottles at a time. And, man, you have a lot of friends if you... Wow! You know, and I never one time had the slightest bit of interest in getting high on drugs. I hated drug highs. I mean, I want to be, when I drink, I want to be in a bar, snapping my fingers, having a good time playing. I don't want to be on the nod over in some corner, you know, saying, boy, I feel wonderful. I mean, that's just not my style. You know, there's a lot of people, that's their style. It's what they like. Not me. I like to be up snapping my fingers. I like to go for 2 or 3 days at a time, you know, and just go and party. And if you got enough dextroamphetamine sulfate, you can do that. You know, it was always hard for me to refer to that as speed. Because, you know, this was made by Smith, Klein, and French. You know, speed is what some dude out in the desert makes in his garage. And all I ever cared about was just making sure I had plenty of dextroamphetamine sulfate so I could drink enormous quantities of alcohol and stay awake for days at a time. And I had an entourage that wouldn't quit. Man, I mean, the bar was full when I arrived every afternoon about 5 o'clock from work. Because I just give the stuff away. I mean, it never occurred to me to sell it. I mean, I got as much as I wanted for $5.75 a thousand. Why would I want to sell it? And so you know what happened. Slowly, inexorably, I drink more and more. I take more and more speed to keep drinking more and more. I eat less and less. I get to work later and later. I leave earlier and earlier. Sometimes I don't come back from lunch. Occasionally, once a week I don't come back from lunch. Twice a week I don't come back from lunch. 5 times a week I don't come back from lunch. And I just sink right into the quicksand of alcoholism. It is not a pleasant memory for me to look back and see that my children, both of whom are alcoholics and drug addicts, and we all know why. You're looking at the primary reason why my children are alcoholics and drug addicts. I'm going to tell you about my son in a minute, but he's in AA, but not my daughter. She's still out there doing it. But my children, every decision that was made in their lives until their mother left me when they were 12 and 10 years old, every decision that was made in their lives as to where they were going to live, what clothes they were going to wear, where they were going to school, what toys they were going to get for Christmas. I mean, every decision concerning them was made by a practicing drunk. Every decision made in my home that I participated in was made by a practicing alcoholic. And if you want to see family dysfunction, that's the primary ingredient. My family was dysfunctional because I was in it. We just destroy our families. And my first wife, it's been a long time since we were together. I mean, she had the good sense to leave me. And I have no idea how she took it as long as she did. But she has just can't seem to choose anything but an alcoholic to get married to. And now she sits at home alone at night, drinking scotch, taking Valium, with a loaded gun on the table beside her. And we just infect everybody around us. And, you know, it has to come to an end. And that's why I am so profoundly grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous that my grandchildren have never seen their parents so much as take a drink. Alcoholics Anonymous has stopped the insanity in our family. We're all in it. But the insanity at the moment is stopped in our family. It's not going to be passed on. And I'm very grateful for that. But I took it just as far as it would go. Took it as far as I could possibly take it. That doctor who saw me when I first came in, his name is Michael, and he said, you know, Dave, when you first walked in, I just almost didn't bother to come over and say hello to you because, you know, I looked at you and I thought, boy, this guy's not going to live another 3 days. He's going to be dead. And so I took it as far as you can go. Well, not quite as far as my wife. I mean, I was not pronounced dead on arrival. I mean, dead is dead. I wasn't quite there yet. But I took it about as far as it would go, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no hope when I got here. I had no faith in anything. I didn't expect any big miracles. You know, when I got here, I would have settled for 10 grand and a cute girl. I mean, that shows you where my aspirations were. And I began the process of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And over the last 22 years, I have gone from where Alcoholics Anonymous was something that I did to the point where it's now who I am. Alcoholics Anonymous has become who I am. My whole life revolves around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it. I find it very pleasurable to interact with people that are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I find it more and more difficult to interact with those normal people out there in the world. They don't get it. And, you know, Polly and I were talking this afternoon when we got back from dinner and just how wonderful all you people are and how much we've just really grown to love you in the short time that we've been here. You know, and what a wonderful group of people you are. See, that's just AA. You know, there's no way we could have gotten along otherwise like that, you know. That's just AA. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I did the very best job I could to work the steps and to keep faith with this program, and slowly the magic has happened to me. Slowly the personality has changed. And I need to share some of my good fortune with you. About 4 years ago, my son Michael, be 5 years in March, called me. My son Michael was just a total blown-out, garbage-mouth drug addict. And Polly and I have 4 kids between us. She has 2 boys, and I have a boy and a girl. And she told you about her 2 boys. I'll tell you about my 2. My son Michael is, first of all, my son Michael is gay. And I found that out after a long time. You know, I didn't know that for a long time. And I have never had any trouble with that, really. I've been sort of, you know, I just didn't have that much of a problem with it. I mean, I was neither happy nor unhappy about that at first. But I have watched my son Michael go from a garbage mouth drug addict to someone that I am so proud of, I can just barely stand it. And it has nothing to do with anything I did. It has only to do with what Alcoholics Anonymous did in his life. He called me up and said, I can't go anymore. There's an outpatient program here that I can get into, and I'm going to go to it, and I just wanted you to know. Well, Mike has taken a run at getting sober before, and nothing much ever happened. And so I didn't really think that much about it. I didn't suddenly think, oh boy, this is it. But it turns out that was it. He went to that program, and he began going to AA meetings, and he got a sponsor. And he lives down in Texas. You know, I take no credit for what happened to him. This was his thing, not anything I did, except pray for him. And the next thing you know, he calls me up, and he and some of the other mutts that he hangs around with have formed, they got a church going down there. And they don't do this instead of AA. They do this in addition to AA. And they gather up every Sunday morning. And they just have a church service. And he goes to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and all that. And he's sober and he's happy. And I'm really so happy for him that he did this. But what makes me really proud of him is that this, when he went into that drug program, that 30-day outpatient program, one of the things they do when you do that is they give you a screening for other problems. And when they did that to him, he found out he was HIV positive. And it scared him to death, and it just kind of broke my heart. But from that day until this, he has been totally asymptomatic. And what my son does in his spare time, and he has a lot of spare time, because see, the way we've structured things is that he's not allowed to work. There is free drug treatment for him. I mean, you know, the drugs for HIV and so forth are very expensive. But he gets free drug treatment, those drugs free from the state, as long as his income doesn't exceed a certain amount. So he has to stay on some program in Social Security. I don't know anything about it, but he has to stay on that program. The SSI, is that what it is? Yeah, he has to stay on that, or he loses his eligibility for the drugs that he takes. But those drugs have worked well in his life. He has been totally asymptomatic for the whole time, for years, and still is. But he does not sit at home. What he does is every day he goes down to the Loving Spoonful, and he works in a place that feeds victims that have full-blown AIDS. And he picks them up at their home, and he takes them to see doctors. Once a month, he takes a van full of them up to Houston. He lives down in Corpus Christi. He takes a van of them up to Houston for dental care. He's a full-blown volunteer, and he works with people in Alcoholics Anonymous and people who have AIDS. And he does that as just a volunteer. He gets paid nothing for that. And I'm so proud of him, I can just barely stand it. Through Alcoholics Anonymous, he has learned to love some of the most unlovable people. We're all scared of people that have full-blown AIDS. I don't know, you know, whether we admit it or not, we are. And that's okay. I'm not making an indictment, you know, because it's a scary thing. It really is a scary thing. And my son has more courage than I think I'll ever have. And you have taught him to love the unlovable. And I am so grateful to you for that. My daughter is still out there. She lives in Denver. And she's still, out there shucking and jiving, making her game. And I don't know if she'll ever get here. That's not my deal. No, I do what I can. I pray for her, and I hope that she makes it. If there's anything ever that I can do, I will. But you know how it is. You know, if you don't want what we have, you're not willing to go to any length to get something you really don't want. And so there's just not much that can be done. My life has not always been easy and wonderful. You know, Polly mentioned to you last night when she was talking that when I was 57 years old, hard at work on the 5-year plan for the company that I worked for. They walked in and said, forget the 5-year plan, you're all laid off. And I was 57 years old and didn't think that much about it, really. I mean, I'd never had any trouble finding a job. I mean, computers, don't you know? They always need us. And I found out not only did I have trouble finding a job, I had trouble finding anything. I was out of work for about a year and a half. Well, out of work, not completely out of work. I worked as a retail clerk for a while for minimum wage. And I found a couple other little odd things to do, but nothing very promising. And finally,
a friend of mine in Alcoholics Anonymous called and said, we're going to hire a consultant for a little job that they have. Would you like to come in and talk to this guy about doing it? And I said, sure. And I went in, and he had a little job that was supposed to last a month or two, paid $15 an hour, and not exactly big wages for a hotshot computer scientist. But I was grateful to get that because I was making minimum wage, so that was quite a step up for me. And it was 2 or 3 months worth of work, so what did it matter anyway? And I went in there with just that, willing to do that. And I showed up every morning on time, and I worked all day. And I was, before that 2 or 3 months was up, it stretched out to another 2 or 3 months. And before it was all over with, they offered me a job. And I gratefully took it. Until I realized one day what was going on. What they wanted me to do was work on a help desk. A help desk. Can you believe that? A guy like me worked on a help desk? You know, some dude on earth out in West Virginia is going to call and say, her computer's acting funny. Can I help her? Are you kidding me? I'm a big-time guy. I was a vice president when I was 34 years old. What do you mean a help desk? You know, I've been manager of systems architecture. I've been manager of advanced communications technology. I used to be on an ANSI committee, American National Standards Institute. I used to go to meetings at the National Bureau of Standards in Gaithersburg and go up to Canada and meet with the Canadian Ministry of Standards. And I mean, what do you mean, help desk? I'm a big shot. I was humiliated. And like most other things that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out I'd just been given a blessing and didn't even know it. They talk about people getting to be 57 years old and in the bloated ranks of middle management, and they get old and tired and bored. Well, guess what? I had gotten old and tired and bored and didn't even know it. I took that help desk job, and you got to be on your toes. You got to know stuff. You got to get there on time. They insist on it. They'll talk to you in harsh tones if you're late very often. You know, they want you to come back right on time after lunch and stay till quitting time. You only have to. What do you mean leave early? You work on a help desk. You don't leave early. So I found out my job skills, my ethics, you know, my work ethic had just kind of gotten real crappy. And I like to think I can go in when I go in. And if I want to bail out for a couple hours in the afternoon and go down and cruise around and look at a new backpack and get some frozen yogurt, no problem, I can do that. Well, now I can't. Everybody's watching me. I have to stay there. And then the darndest thing happened. Pretty soon, these doodah nurses from West Virginia became friends of mine. I knew what their husband's name was, and I knew how many kids they had. You know, and the ones from Ohio, still remember them. The ones from all over the state of California, the ones in New Mexico, they used to call me. They would call my personal number because they wanted to talk to me. They wanted me to help them. Because, you know, I made a deal with myself and with God. I said, you know, I'm going to do this job as good as I can. And these people are having enough trouble as it is. They're not computer whizzes, and they get very frustrated with computers, and it's my job to help them do their job. And their job is to be a nurse and provide health care. And my job is to help them use a computer to do that. And I'm going to do my job with a good attitude, and I'm not ever going to make anybody feel like they're stupid or they don't know anything, or why are you bothering me with this or anything else. I'm going to be cheerful and I'm going to be helpful. And I learned to get there on time and to stay there and be just like everybody else and to be helpful. And in the process, my work ethic was restored. I am now, by the time I got out of that job 4 years later, I knew the hottest stuff that's being delivered in software today, in computers today. I'm working with Windows 95, Windows NT, Novell NetWare, everything. All the stuff I am now extremely confident in. My skills are totally current, right up to the minute. And 4 years of that, and one day I walked in and they said, well, Dave, we're going to sell a company. We're going to shut her down. We're selling it to a company over in Albuquerque. And this company in Albuquerque said, "Oh boy, Dave, you're really going to like living in Albuquerque." And I said, "I don't think so. I don't know what I'm going to do, but me and the girl, well, I thought I'll be courteous. I'll go home and ask probably what she thinks about Albuquerque. And good taste prevents me from telling you. It wasn't very much." And so, I thought, well, here you go again. Only now the computer scientist is not 57 anymore. He's 61. So one day I get an email from somebody I used to work with. And he said, "Hey, Dave, I know a really good job that's opening up with another company in the same industry, healthcare. And if you like, I can give you their address and you can send them a resume. And, I think it's a good job. You might want to contact them." So I sent these people a resume. They contacted me, and they knew who my ex-boss was at the other company, and they knew the person that had given them as a reference. And on the strength of the references I got from those two people, I was essentially hired by this new company. And I went in for an interview, and I said, the company that bought us over there in New Mexico offered me a very handsome bonus if I would stay with them through a transition period. It's 6 months' salary. It's kind of a nice deal. And I got 3 months to go on that. So if you offer me a job, it's going to be very hard for me to figure out which way to go here. And they said, "Well, we'll just wait for you." So they waited for 3 months till I become available. The job I have today is I have complete autonomy. My boss, my direct supervisor, lives in Kokomo, Indiana. And we communicate by telephone and by email. He came out without ever having met me face to face, had never seen me before. He came out with a stack of papers that thick. "Here, sign here, sign here. Here, here's your new laptop. Here, pick out a company car you'd like to have. You're going to need a home office. Put in a phone and buy whatever equipment you need. Send me the bill." He just came in and gave me all this stuff. I have a new car I drive. I mean, it's brand new. And he gave me all this stuff. And he says, "I got to go home. I live in Kokomo. Send me an email now and then. Tell me how you're doing. Give me a monthly report and I'll see you later." And he went home. And I talked to him the other day, and now he's saying, "I'm pretty sure I can get this. I was hired in April." He says, "I'm pretty sure I can get you a promotion right now to the next level up and a real nice raise." But he said, "It would really be great if you could do this CNA thing. It's a little thing that we have to do." He said, "If you could do that within the time frame, I know you're really busy, and we can postpone it if you need to." But he said, "I'm pretty sure that by the time you get that, I can make the raise. We're going to give you a retroactive back to June." I mean, See, so what I thought when I got laid off, it's the end of the world. I can't find another job, some wage. And what I found out was that I was getting a blessing and didn't even know it. Didn't feel like a blessing to me at first. Many of my blessings don't, because I got to figure it out up here, and this doesn't work. One of the greatest things I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous, you taught me that my whole approach to life doesn't work. Okay, my way doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It never has. Never has. Doing the very best job I could do. I wasn't fooling around out there, folks. I was doing as good as I could. But doing the very best job I could do for me, I turned me into a first-class derelict. That's as good as I can do without you and without God. I mean, that's my very best effort. Because I did it. I just turned me into a derelict. I never made a decision in my life that I thought would be harmful to me. Never. Every decision I made. You ever heard that old Tom What's-His-Name song? "All I'm looking for is faster horses, younger women, older whiskey, and more money." I mean, I'm really trying to make a success of my life, and I just turned me into a derelict. And finally, I have to put myself in the hands of a bunch of self-professed alcoholics, and my life turns around. And if I'm willing to do what you ask me to do, my life really works well. Now, I think I had the neatest lady in the world to be married to. And when I got here, I was absolutely positive a decent woman would never have anything to do with me again. I mean, never. Whatever chance I may have ever had to be married to a good, decent woman, I had blown totally, completely, and irrevocably. It's just too late for me. And I have the neatest lady in the world. I just adore her, and she adores me. Isn't that something? My best judgment, my very best thinking, fortunately, got me a front row seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of that, I get to lead a wonderful life that I thoroughly enjoy. My kids, with the exception of my daughter, are doing well. You know, I got a daughter. Polly has a son. We got these kids. We got two of them. My daughter's doing really bad. And we got one boy who we wish, for his own sake, for his own peace of mind and his own happiness, could see his way clear to get involved in Al-Anon and to take advantage of that program. He really needs it, we think. You know, but I just told you how far my thinking has taken me, so, you know, I'm always willing to help God any way I can. Just try to be helpful, God. But my family works, my life works. And it's the darndest thing I've ever seen. I love Alcoholics Anonymous beyond anything I could ever possibly tell you. Beyond anything I could tell you. And my life. When Polly was trying to get sober, she wound up in a treatment center over in Dallas. And this has a big impact on me. So I frequently use this to close my talk with. And she wound up in this treatment center, and she knew the deal. You know, it's the third time she's been in. She's been through a county detox a couple of times before, and she knows what the drill is. You know, you go in, they put you in a room. It's a detox room, and you sit there for a while. A nurse comes. She's got a tray, glass of water, a couple of pills. You know, they give you something to help you keep from rattling around too much. And they put you to bed, and tomorrow you wake up, and you go to meetings, and every day, and you go to therapy, and you do group, and stuff like that. So she knew what the deal was, and so she's waiting for it to begin, sitting there in her room, and nobody's showing up with any meds. So she pranced on down to the nurse's station and announced that she was ready for her meds. And this guy named Bill T. Perteller said, "Not this time, Polly. You need to know how sick you really are. We're not going to let you die, but there's not going to be any meds. You need to know how sick you really are." And the next 4 days were an unmitigated hell. And she had DTs. She was scratched up from clawing things off of herself and pulling her hair out and all that. And 4 days later, she walked out of there, and she got in Bill T. Perteller's face and said, "You know, you son of a bitch, I hate you. You don't treat an animal like you've treated me for the last 4 days." And he took her by the shoulders and said, "Polly, if you make it, you're going to love me. If you don't make it, it really doesn't matter. So if you have a sponsor that's suggesting you do a lot of things that sound like a pretty bad idea to you, they're contrary to the way you feel, and your program thinks you ought to do things that you don't think are a very good idea, and people are mentioning service just a little more often than you care to hear it, and all that, just try to remember, if you make it, you're going to love us. But if you don't make it, it really doesn't matter." Thanks very much.
Okay, let me start over by saying good morning.
Good morning.
And I just want to let you know how much Dave and I have enjoyed being with you guys. It's just fabulous. What a wonderful group of people. Guys. He's got a microphone back there. At any rate, what we're going to do this morning may be something a little different than what you've done in the past. I don't know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But what we're going to do is a guided meditation. And I'm going to turn off the lights, and I want you to just sit back, get comfortable. Whatever's, just don't cross anything. Just keep your arms and your hands not crossed. And just sit. If you want to lay on the floor, that's fine. If you want to sit in a chair, however you want to do it, just get comfortable. Then just listen to the meditation. Don't force anything. I know this is asking too much of an alcoholic mind, but don't force. Just let whatever comes, come. And then when we get through with the meditation, I'm going to leave the music play and just go to your paper and write whatever comes to you. Don't force. And what you will be having on your paper is what we call God talking, because that's all that's going to come up. Don't force anything. If nothing comes, don't worry about it. It just wasn't supposed to. The main thing is don't force the thought. Just write whatever comes. Just relax. Just don't try to empty your mind. As I'm talking, just try to empty your mind. And as the meditation goes, just try, you know, just let what comes, come. Don't force. And then, when you feel the inclination, then write that. And what happens is when we get done, those who care to can share. And I think what you will find is that it is a very powerful experience. And it might surprise you if you've never done it before. So, okay, somebody wants to hit the lights. And Don's going to hit the, there you go, and Don's going to hit the music. Okay, just relax. Just sit comfortably. Take some deep breaths. Just breathe in, breathe out, let go, let God. Breathe in, God, breathe out, doubt. Let go. Let God. Just a few more deep breaths. Don't force. Just breathe. Pay attention to your breath. Just pay attention to your breath. Now, let us center ourselves in God's love. Settle back into your body. Feel the peace flowing through you. This is love energy. Love energy is peace energy. You are coming into peace. Breathe in peace. Breathe out. Be still. Peace. Be still. Peace. Be still. My Creator, I admit I am powerless, that my life has become unmanageable without your help and guidance. It has become unmanageable in many ways, For I like the power to do the things I would do, and many times I lack the power not to do the things I will not do. I have not the power to control my thoughts and actions at times, and have not the power to control others or situations. And Father, in this trying to control and to manipulate, I have made my life so very unmanageable. But I have come to believe that a power greater than myself can and will, if I seek for this power, restore and renew me to order and harmony. It will renew me to a right relationship to myself and others. I am coming to believe myself a child of this Creator or higher power, and as such a worthy being in my higher power's eyes, as well as worthy in my own eyes. I am beginning to express the hope that my life can become in order with my higher power's help. I now come to you today, Father, to believe you can and will restore and renew me to meet my needs this day. I now ask and become willing to receive that help as I make the decision to turn my will, my life, my thoughts, my desires, ambitions, actions over to this power, my Father, as I understand you. What I understand you to be is a life force of light. Whatever manifestation I need your loving acceptance, that acceptance of my total being. No matter what I may have done or failed to do, everlasting arms to love me are beneath me, around me, and above me, for this is your promise. I now turn my will and my life over to this love, this force of love energy. I also release my loved ones to this love. Father God, you know what is best for all concerned. My best, the best for my loved ones, the best for my children, the best for my mate, the best for my family members, the best for my friends, the best for my fellow workers, the best for any, every, and all the various situations of my life. I pray for this best, for the highest good for me and all concerned around me. God, I trust you and your will for my life and those I release into your perfect care. You will be done in my life as well as those I love. I will now make a searching and fearless inventory of myself. I will clear out all my relationships. I will look at a particular situation that is causing me pain, and I will examine my part of this situation. Now I have let pride, fear, resentment, anger, or self-pity distort that situation and my thinking, thus making it worse. I will take full responsibility for all my actions in this situation. I admit to you, God, and to myself, the truth of this situation and what part I have played. I accept my responsibility, and I now become willing to let go of the defects that have caused not only myself, but others pain in this situation. I acknowledge the exact nature of my wrongs, and Father, I know that my wrongs also go back to self and self-centeredness. I know there is only love or fear. When I am in fearful, negative emotions, I have lost the contact with you and I and myself. I am now willing to get out of self and back into a state of love and harmony. I give you all this situation, knowing you will work it out in accordance with your will. I ask now, Father, that you take all of me, the good and the bad. I humbly ask that you remove my shortcomings and every single defect of character that stands in the way between me and my usefulness to you and those you would have me help. My friends and loved ones, I cannot control or change, so release them into your care to do with as you will. Keep me loving and free from judgment of them or myself. If there is any changing, God, you'll have to do it. I can't. Just make me willing and ready to be changed, and ready to be of service to you, to do my best. I thank you that you are in the process of removing these things from me, so that I may be of total use to you and my fellow through love energy, which takes away all negatives. Negatives cannot exist in your love. Love energy is the most powerful force that you can bring into our lives. Father God, help me to see how I have harmed others. I will now make a list of all the persons that I have harmed in any way in this situation. I now look within my heart for the willingness to rectify any and all wrongs. I become willing as I surrender self-righteousness and justification to you and receive love and forgiveness in its place. I will make direct amends to any and all persons whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I know that you, Father, will direct these individuals to me in your perfect sense of timing for these amends to be made, and you will give me wisdom and insight in order to make the proper kind of amends to heal this relationship. I continue to take personal inventory, and when I am wrong, I promptly admit it. Dear God, keep me ever mindful of the little foxes that creep back into my life, the sins of my personality that harm you, myself, and others, that separate and cut me off from your light, love, and spirit. And when I commit these errors, make me aware of them and help me to admit each one promptly. Help me to stay centered in your love and in your power. When I stray and get out in the weeds of self, help me to make a trail back to the path I should follow and to ask the people I might hurt along the way to forgive me. Help me forgive them also. I know that all human beings are frequently wrong, and that I am not any exception. Help me to accept my own humanity, loving Father, and the humanity in others. My Creator, I seek the sunlight and warmth of your Spirit. I thirst to know you better, to love you more. So I come to you through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with you, Father. I ask for the knowledge of your will for my life and the power to carry it out. What can I do for you today? I have placed myself and my loved ones in your care. I know that nothing can happen to us that is outside your care or not for our future good and usefulness to you. That being the case, I now say, Thy will be done. Thy love be done. Your will is for good and always works for good. I look to you only, my Father. I give you my life. And this is my desire, to be in your presence, knowing that your grace is sufficient. Now just relax, listen to the music, and when you feel inclined, just begin to write. And then those who care to will share the writings, and since Dave and I need to catch a plane at 10:30, I'm just going to sign off the tape now, and when we get through with the writings, those that care to will share. God bless. Godspeed.